Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 36 of Season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Duncan Shields of the Time Bandit Minute, plus a whole bunch of other things that he'll tell us about at some point. Welcome to the show, Duncan.
Hello there. It's excellent. I'm glad to see you again.
Yeah, I always have trouble, you know, remembering all the different stuff that you do. You do like 50 different things all at once, you know.
Yeah.
And I keep remembering that award that you got in high school, you know, that everything. So, yeah. So, welcome to the show. And hopefully, you know, you got your Dalmatian in tow and that you're all ready to get going on Die Hard with me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it.
All right, great. So minute 36 begins with fire trucks coming from the distance and ends with Tony talking about a fire. Mm-hmm. Sounds interesting, right? So everyone who was paying attention and was listening on Friday, so we ended things by, you know, John pulling a little, I guess you could say, high school prank, you know.
Yes.
pulling the fire alarm. You know,
and classic.
It's great that there's a quick response, especially on New Year's Eve, you know, in the middle of downtown LA. You know, we saw at the end of Friday's minute, there were four trucks that were on their way and John was looking out the window and was really, really happy. So this minute basically continues that. We get a shot of these fire trucks in the distance as they are coming towards we see it from John's viewpoint. So they're coming towards the screen, you know, even though it's quite a distance, but we can still see, you know, we see where they are and what we see that they are fire trucks.
Yeah, so he's really up in the crow's nest there. He's got a great view of the surrounding 6 miles of LA from.
Yeah. Come on. He's on the 32nd floor of a 34 story building. So you know, he's got a really, really nice view. You know,
yeah.
I mean, if I remember correctly, we can actually even hear the fire trucks, the sirens, but that doesn't make sense because I doubt that from that high up, he's going to be able to hear the sirens.
Oh, they're loud. He might faintly be able to. They might be.
No, but the window's closed.
Oh, sorry. That's right.
He's not hanging out the window yet.
And they're not flimsy. Yeah, they're not flimsy windows up there. Yeah, you probably wouldn't be able to hear them.
Right. So, I mean, one of the first things I wanted to ask you, so what do you know about fire engines, fire trucks?
Not too much. I like that I always like looking at old fire trucks, the old horse-drawn carriage runs that seem to be just like operated on hope and good intentions and, you know, good firemen. I remember there was a friend of mine was a fireman, and he used to have a prank that he would play on the little kids that would be taken around the firehouses on tours. And what they would do is they would put one of the firemen into one of the compartments on the fire truck. And so when they were taking the kids around, they would say, like, this is where we keep the ladders. These are the pressure gauges for the hose. And if the fire is, you know, out of control, this is where we keep the extra fireman if we need one. And then open up the compartment, and he'd be curled up in the compartment. He'd be like, hello. And then they would, like, close the compartment and keep on doing the tour, like...
As if nothing had happened.
As if nothing had happened. And, you know, he said it was remarkable how many of the kids were like, well, that makes sense. And, you know, you just know that some of them made it into their 30s going, yeah, the extra fireman. What are you guys – I've seen it with my own eyes. They keep an extra fire. It took a long time for some of them to realize that it was a joke. But I don't know too much about the history of fire trucks.
Right. Okay. Well, most people don't. I didn't either before I decided to look it up, you know. So first of all, do you know any other names for a fire truck?
No.
I found four. Okay. So besides a fire truck, you have it could be called a fire engine, a fire truck, a fire lorry, or a Nino. Sure.
Oh, right. Like the siren.
It could be. Yeah. Okay.
Well, I know in the UK, like we and over here, if I do a siren impression, I'm like, wee you, like, but over there they say me ma, and it's a different, different.
Well, wait, is it Mima or Nina? Because here
it's
what I see is written as Nina with an N, not an M.
Yeah, and I figure that's a variation on Mima.
Okay, so maybe Mima is also one of the terms. It could be. I thought Mima's like a grandmother or something, isn't it?
Yeah, Meemaw, you can call your grandmother. But I remember there was like
So they're
there was
saying that fire trucks remind them of their grandmother calling them to come in?
a No, it's just an onomatopoeia for the sound, for the sound effect of the siren. Like I remember there was an ad I saw where it was like, "What if the world had no sound?" And there was these fire trucks and the firemen in this in the that were driving it in the cab had cardboard signs up. And they said me on one side and ma on the other, MAW. And they were flipping the sides back and forth in lieu of the siren because in this world there was no sound, kind of thing. But I remember as a stranger or as somebody that was new to the UK, I was like, what do the words me and ma have to do with a fire engine? This ad is very confusing to me. And then somebody was like, no, that's the sound that sirens make, me ma. And I'm like, technically accurate, I guess, but I've never heard it expressed like that. Okay, sure. Me, ma. All right. I get that. So yeah, if they're calling,
Is very
if another
possible.
place, yeah. So Nina, Mima, I figure it's the same thing.
Okay. Thank you for explaining that one to me. I didn't know what that meant. So a fire engine is a road vehicle that's usually a truck, but not always, that functions as a firefighting apparatus. The primary purpose is to transport firefighters or water to an incident, while it's also carrying the equipment for the firefighting operations. Okay, most fire engines have sirens and emergency vehicle lighting. And do you know when the first mention of some sort of fire truck was used? You know, a device, sorry, a device that was used to squirt water on fire.
I'm guessing some Victorian novel. That would be my guess.
No, it goes back even further. So originally, there is mention from the 2nd century BC in
Holy wow.
Ctesibius of Alexandria. He invented the very first fire pump, which was known either as a squirt or a fire syringe. Okay.
Sure, a fire syringe. Why not? Sure, okay.
Again, it makes sense if you think about it from today's perspective on it. And then in 1650, there was a guy who named Hans Hauch, who built a fire engine that was used from a compressed air vessel. So on each side, they had 14 men working a piston rod back and forth in a horizontal direction, and they were able to then, shoot out a stream of water up to
Wow.
20 meters, which is 65.6 feet, which is pretty amazing to how
So
far
you've
that
just
could
got
go.
20 guys just reefing on this pole back and forth, back and forth, back and forth until the fire's out.
Apparently, yeah.
Wow, that's just like hands on oars in a galley. Like that's
Completely.
just you swap them out. That'd be something to see.
Yeah.
Wow.
Go when you get that time machine done, you can go take a look. Go back to
Yeah.
go back to 1650 and try and find that. Okay. In
Start as
Cologne,
many fires. Start as
there you
many
go.
fires
Start
as
as many
possible.
fires. Yeah, but that would be the butterfly effect if you do that. You never know what you're burning down. You could be dirt burning down, the trees that Abraham Lincoln would later use to make his log cabin or something like that. Who
That's
knows?
right.
So in colonial America, there were laws that every house had to have a bucket of water on their front stoop in preparation
Okay.
for fire. Okay,
Sure.
and therefore they would have what was known as the bucket brigade.
Yeah.
That would be in charge of running to each of these houses and taking the buckets in order to use them if there was a fire.
Yeah, I've heard of that for sure.
In 1719, a Philadelphia obtained the first hand-pumped fire engine, and they were able to then use that to try and put out fires also.
Nice.
What else? So at the end, in the mid-19th century, most fire engines were just used by men, maneuvered by men.
Yeah.
But then someone thought of the idea of having the horse-drawn fire engines, what you referred to earlier,
Yeah.
which was which would able to was able to improve the response time to getting to fire
Yeah.
incidents.
No doubt.
So the problem was is that a lot of the firefighters got upset about this because it was taking away some of the work that they were doing. And they would
Okay.
sabotage the device. And
would they sabotage the device or would they sabotage the horse?
They would sabotage. I don't know. It says here, it says that they had a steam pumper fire engine that was built in New York in 1841, and that was something that the firefighters would sabotage all the time because it bothered them.
I imagine that a couple of horses might have also been sabotaged.
It's possible. When do you think the first motorized fire engine came around?
1998.
Excuse me? 1998 or 1898?
No, I would say probably 1850. I got to go 1850. I don't know much about the automotive history in general. That might be before the first car.
But it's long before the first car, but the first motorized fire engine was in 1897.
Okay.
In Paris.
Ah, of course.
Of course. And
because, as they say, Paris is burning.
That could be. That's where we, I guess, you know what? That could be where that comes from. That's very true. Wow, I never thought about that.
Kind of a cool correlation.
Yeah, seriously. For many years, the firefighters used to sit or stand on the side of the fire engines, or on the back. And apparently, it's very uncomfortable for them, and in many cases, it's very dangerous. There were a lot of firefighters who were actually killed because when the fire engine would make a sharp turn, and they would go flying. Yeah. You know, they'd go in the other direction. So what they do is nowadays, just about every fire engine has enclosed areas where the crew can sit.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So yeah, that's what I got about fire engines.
Nice. So, yeah. I like when he's so happy. You know, like there was a bit in Tron where they asked Jeff Bridges, like, why do you want to go back into ENCOM and get your secrets back so much? And he goes, because, man, they own stuff that I own. Like that because, man, is so Jeff Bridges. And then here, when Bruce Willis is looking out the window and laughing, and he's like, ha ha ha, ha ha.
Yeah. You know, like he starts off by saying, yes, oh baby, come to papa, yes, come on.
Oh baby, come to papa. And then he says, I'll kiss your f-ing Dalmatian, yeah. Which I think is.
Exactly. He goes, baby, come on, baby, come on, baby, come to papa. I'll kiss your Dalmatian.
I hope, like, from the bottom of my soul that was improv and that he just threw that in there.
You'll find out by the end of the episode when we talk about the script. So you'll find out then whether it's there or not. But I'll keep you in suspense just like everybody else.
I like what he says there. I like his laugh. It's a very Bruce Willis laugh. And I also got into, like, that made me go down the history of Dalmatians a little bit.
Okay, I did too. We'll get there in a second. Because before that, I wanted to talk about the fact, first of all, I love the way that he's jumping up and back, jumping up and down during this whole thing also. One point, he jumps up and looks like he's skipping in place, you know, by the way that he's doing that. And he's pacing back and forth. He's completely thrilled about the fact that these fire trucks are coming to save the day, you know,
really, and stoked. Like, finally something's going right.
Yeah.
You know,
and then we see the shot of the trucks itself, of themselves again, as they're coming. And you can see on the right hand corner of the thing, you see a big sign that says Ralph's.
Yeah. I looked this up. I thought, you know, of course it isn't, because this is just a shot of LA and CG at the time for replacing this kind of stuff wasn't really good. And, you know, they could have made a couple of big signs, but I just always assumed, since I'd never heard of it, they made it for the movie.
They made up the name Ralph's?
Yeah. Okay. And so they just got a couple of big, like, it was.
All right. Well, I'm going to have to burst your bubble here.
What I'm saying.
Oh.
I looked it up and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's an actual Southern California, you know, grocery store.
It's apparently one of the largest grocery stores grocery store chain in Southern California.
In Southern California, which is kind of a strange claim. It's like the biggest chain in Southern California.
Well, Southern California is pretty big. So,
I mean, I don't know if that, like, seven stores. I'm not sure what that
is. No. It's a lot more.
It's not just that it's the oldest in Southern California. It's like, I mean, the largest in Southern California. It was like, it's the oldest supermarket chain west of the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
The first one was about 1873 was the first one,
Yep.
and some famous architects like built some of them, and that's wild. And I looked it up on Google Maps, and that particular Ralph's is still there, right
Yeah,
beside the
completely.
Nakatomi Building.
That's great.
So.
That's great. You took up some of the stuff I researched Russell, but that's great because I guess
Yeah.
no, because you now know what to look for when you're recording with me. You know the type of things I'm looking for, so you want to make sure that you do your homework here. So that's good. So as you mentioned, it was founded in 1873 by two brothers named George Albert Ralphs and Walter Benjamin Ralphs. And they opened a little store, and it ended up growing and growing and growing, till it became, as we said, it became the largest supermarket chain in Southern California. They were a grocery pioneer that they would offer self-serve markets with checkout stands in various locations and stuff like that.
Yeah, because I remember back in the day, you walked into a store and you told the person there what you wanted, and they went and got it.
Right.
And
Correct.
so it was kind of revolutionary. So you could have a huge warehouse, and it didn't matter because you just have a front line of workers that would go. You give them your list, they would go get it and bring it to you. But
Right.
this idea that you walk in and pick it yourself at one point was like, what?
Exactly.
So they were, that's why they were kind of pioneering.
Right. It's like what you see in old westerns, or you see in like Little House on the Prairie and stuff like that. They go into the local store and they say, okay, give me 2 pints of this and 6 pounds of that and all this thing, and someone's doing it for you.
Yeah, and the store, a general store too, right? So you've got your groceries on one side and your everything else in the world on the other side. And it's all squirreled away in compartments. So you want somebody who knows where everything is,
For sure.
to just go pick it up for you.
Correct. So do you know what other movies or different, what other famous places have we seen Ralph's?
No, I don't know.
Whether we're talking about in other media or whatever. So first of all, there's a Ralph's grocery store next to University of Hollywood in Beverly Hills.
Oh, so we've probably seen it a whole bunch then.
No, but I'm saying there's a real one there. Depends. It's not like for a set or anything like that. It's a real store that people can go to. It's probably not this one that we get to see here.
No, that one is, just down the street from,
Right.
what is it, Plaza, Century Plaza? What's the
No,
actual
this is
building?
10, this is 20th Century Plaza, I believe, where Nakatomi is, right?
So that Ralph's is literally there. So that's not the one next to
Exactly. That's not the one next to Universal Hollywood. Right. So you mentioned before about a Jeff Bridges movie. There's another Jeff Bridges movie that has Ralph's predominantly featured in it. Any clue?
Fisher King?
Nope. The Big
Okay.
Lebowski.
Oh,
Wait a second. Doesn't
really?
The Fisher King take place in New York?
It does.
Oh,
So I would be. Yeah, that's not a point in my favor. You're right. That's
Yeah. Sorry. No, that's fine. That's fine. That's fine. So in The Big Lebowski, the dude. Okay, is start the movie starts off with him walking through the Ralph's supermarket, and then later on, when he's being searched by the police, right, they find his Ralph's card, and they ask him, "Is this your only form of ID?" Okay,
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
right, and then
Is that so? So is he and Ralph's paying for a pint of milk with his with by check? Is that right?
yes,
Okay.
exactly. Then when he's in the mortuary. So Walter starts complaining about the high price of the urn, right? In order to put their friend Donnie in, right? So then he asks the funeral director, "Is there a Ralph's around here?" And then the next thing we see them holding a Folgers coffee can, that they apparently bought at Ralph.
That's right. Okay. Yeah, like it's like how for a long time phone numbers were all 555.
They
Like
pretty
I
much
just
still
was
are.
I
They still use
assumed.
it as much as possible.
Yeah, because if you use a real phone number, you got to clear it and you got to make sure that it's not an actual phone number, and that's a hassle. So, but I like whenever I saw Ralph's, I guess I might have seen Ralph's in six different movies and just assumed
That it was
it
fake.
was the
Okay.
Eat at Joe's of the supermarket
Right.
world.
Okay, that
Like
makes
it's
sense.
just, but it, to find out that it's a legit chain, I was like, oh, great, cool, of course.
Yeah, for sure. So Did you ever see the movie Forever Young with Mel Gibson? He plays like
Oh.
a test pilot that is accidentally frozen, cryogenically frozen for like 50 years. And then when he wakes up, he calls a friend, and he's across the street. He's across the street from the payphone. Across the street from the payphone that he's calling from, there's a Ralph's, right? And then
All right.
someone asks him later on, "Where's your friend live?" And he says, "Well, there's a place called Ralph's there now.
Oh, okay.
They built a supermarket where his friend had apparently lived beforehand."
That rings a bell. I might have saw it. I might
Right.
have
I
seen
mean,
it
there's
in
I
passing.
found tons of other references, but most of them are things that I don't really I'm not familiar with. There's in Repo Man, there's one. In the TV show Mad Men, Don Draper carries a Ralph's bag at some point.
Oh, okay.
You have there's in the movie Dolomite from 1975. There's a TV show, an episode of Shazam that features
Oh.
Ralph's. Back in I think it's the 70s.
Nice.
So I mean there's a lot of references over the time because as you said it's a real place, so why not?
Yeah, well, I always kind of thought it was like that. There's that cafe that that's been in like literally 200 movies. I think it says, I think it's a delicatessen on the front windows. It's like where Gwyneth Paltrow and has that conversation in Seven, where they're like, you spoil
I don't
that, you
remember.
spoil
I'm not a LA person, so I couldn't tell you that though.
it. No, for sure, for sure. But it's not just LA movies.
Right.
It's not a real cafe, but it's a cafe where they've shot tons and tons and tons of conversations. If you if they're having a conversation in a greasy spoon, once you see them, once you look out for it, you're like, oh, there's that cafe again. And I think it's a set. I'm not sure if it's an actual, it might be an actual cafe that's just really close to the lot that they just film on at a moment's notice all the time. But anyway,
It could be.
that's what I kind of figured Ralph's was like. Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, happy to find out
Yeah,
it's a real
me
thing.
too. I agree with you on that. I mean, I never even thought about it beforehand. I never even made the connection with the Big Lebowski, even though I've seen that many times also. So.
And that it's old enough to be like legit if you put it in Mad Men,
Right.
or that
That's true
it's in the
also.
background in like issues of Shazam from like or episodes of Shazam. That's fantastic.
Right. Exactly. All right, so let's move along to what you were mentioning. You started talking about before we started talking about Dalmatians, right?
Yeah, I didn't know that much about Dalmatians. I didn't realize their breed was like super, super old. It's first mentioned in like 1375, and then they started to become like breeds that nobles would have and stuff. So then they started showing up, and because it became a status symbol, they started showing up in like royalty portraits and nobles' portraits. So we actually started to see them in the early 1600s in portraits of famous people.
Yeah,
So
for sure.
it's pretty. They're pretty cool dogs, and they were bred to accompany the carriages of nobles and gypsies and firefighters because they were bred to guard horses and coaches. Because apparently horses and Dalmatians get along just great. They're real pals. So they're good with kids, dependable watchdogs, affable, very athletic. They've got that tight frame. They're good at running, and they got that unique. Spotted coat. If they want to be officially called a Dalmatian and recognized as a Dalmatian, it's got to be in black or brown.
Right. That's true. And it
And
was
if
made popular by Disney.
well, it definitely, yeah, it was like Anheuser-Busch did. Apparently, they were in a lot of the Budweiser commercials because they had the big Clydesdales, and so they had that. But then, yeah, that and 101 Dalmatians definitely. Cemented them in the public consciousness.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, what fascinated me was trying to find out what's the connection with Dalmatians and firefighting, because that's something you hear quite often also over the years.
Yeah.
So I looked up also. So it's Dalmatians are pretty much associated with firefighting because in the days of when they would use a horse-drawn fire engines so that they would have the dogs guard the horses. because the horses didn't like being around the fire. But as you mentioned, having Dalmatians near them were, helped comfort them and make them, make them, I guess, happier that they were there, right? But
Yeah, because it would be like,
once they,
oh, some, a fellow animal is here too.
right,
Okay, well,
exactly.
okay.
Yeah, but not just a fellow animal. You mentioned the fact earlier that horses and
Your pal.
Dalmatians got along really well, so why not?
Your good friend. Your
Right.
good friend, the Dalmatians here, so.
Right. But once they didn't need the horse-drawn fire engines anymore, it was a little bit of a problem. They didn't need the Dalmatians anymore, but a lot of the firefighters wanted to adopt Dalmatians as their mascots. And it just stuck. It's something that over the years,
Well, there.
there's really no connection between Dalmatians and fire itself. Is the connection between Dalmatians and horses, but it stuck, and that's why everyone still thinks of, like, when I think of, if someone were to ask me, okay, what dog would you think of is going to be dealing with, fire, that is associated with firemen or fire trucks, the first thing I would think of is Dalmatians for sure. And that's just because it's been etched in our brains that is acceptable, I guess you can say. That that's the
Yeah, you've
way
got like the, when you think of rescuing skiers that have been trapped in avalanches, you think of Saint Bernards,
Exactly. Right.
and then when you think of firefighters, you think of Dalmatians. There's probably about seven or eight breeds that are like that have like a specific occupation
Right,
or
exactly. And you
association.
think of Amity, so you think of the great white shark, that type of thing. There's things that are, exactly.
It was neat. I always thought it was pretty neat because I was like, how do you get those specific black spots? And it's like, well, it's kind of a gamble. They can be blue spots, they can be brindle, mosaic, orange, lemon, or like tri-colored. And if they are born like that, then you're like, oh, well, that's not officially a Dalmatian. Or they can be born with mostly spots but have one big coloration patch
Right.
somewhere. Like half of their head is black. And then the rest of their body has the black spots. Then it's like, well, too bad. You're
Right.
not a, you know, you can't be entered into the dog show as a Dalmatian,
Did you know that Dalmatians have hearing problems? I
Yeah,
never knew
it's like
that. Maybe
it's
that's how
because
you
of
get
all
them
the
to stay
in
near the fire. Actually, you think if they're, I think if they had, if no, that's how they, that's probably why they can stay by the fire engines, but the fire itself, they would see the fire, not hear it.
Yeah, I would think maybe the sirens of if there was a reason for their deafness, I would assume it was the sirens.
No, it's genetic, they say.
It's genetic because of all because the you got to get that specific coat, so that's created with a lot of interbreeding, and so they're prone to deafness, allergies, hip dysplasia, and urinary stones with bone spurs and arthritis showing up in their late teens. So that's not a fun time being a Dalmatian, it looks like. And the deafness can show up more often in the blue-eyed Dalmatians, so they try to not breed blue-eyed Dalmatians, because I think it's the two recessive genes coming together result in
Right, okay,
the
that makes
deafness.
sense. That makes sense.
But I've always heard that they're really dumb because of the interbreeding. They're really, really stupid.
I don't know.
But I couldn't find any data to back that up, so I think that might just be a myth, or it's a mistranslation of the physical problems that they have to face, because they do have inherent genetic damage, but seems like mentally they're just fine. So,
Okay.
which was good to find
Good to
out.
find out,
Oh, good.
exactly. And as McLean continues to look out the window, we see that the lights start going out on the four trucks that are on their way. And I love how it's in succession. You have the first one go off, then the second, then the third, and then the fourth. And then he starts screaming at them and he goes, "Oh, you stupid motherfuckers. No, no, turn the truck around." And you see that he's sweating profusely as he's
Oh,
screaming.
he's so sweaty. So sweaty. And we get that over the shoulder look when the elevator goes ding and he turns to look at the camera, and that just, perfect every action movie has to have
Yeah, for
the
sure.
look back over the shoulder. And it's like he's just stepped out of the shower.
Yeah,
He's so sweaty.
completely. But before we get there, so
Sorry.
I wanted to focus a little bit on the word mother. All right. So,
Oh,
you know,
wow. Okay.
I did a little bit of research on that one. Where did that come from? You know, so
Yeah.
it's sometimes referred to as, you know, it's abbreviated by saying MOFO, MF, MFers, right? It is obviously
And it was
a vulgarism.
first coined by the guy who invented the water pump in the 2nd century BC when he was trying to build it.
No, it might have been, but you know, that wasn't the first recorded, you know, thing. Now, the word is obviously it's a form of the word fuck, right? It's a word that is usually considered highly offensive. It's rarely used in the literal sense of, you know, talking about someone who is actually engaging in some sort of sexual activity with another person's mother or their own mother. You know, that's just you know, it refers to a mean, despicable, or a vicious person, or any particularly difficult or frustrating situation. Alternatively, it can be used as a term of admiration, as in the term badass motherfucker, meaning a
Sure.
fearless and a confident person. Right? So there are a lot of, you know, terms that people use instead, you know, in order to try to, I guess, hide the, you know, not have to say the actual word itself. So you would say mother humper, mother fugger, mother effer, mother sucker, mother trucker, mother freaker, mother lover, mofo, father mucker, mother flower, mother flipper, mother kisser, and there's so many more that you can use in polite company in order to have to avoid censorship, like everyone who just heard right now all the different beeps, you know, as we're going through all of these.
And these are alternate versions that you can hear all throughout Snakes on a Plane, and you can hear all throughout Usual Suspects. You know,
Yes.
hand me the keys, you fuzzy sock sucker. You know, like
There you go.
you can do all of those. What was it? Oh yeah, that was it. Oh man, get these monkey flinging snakes off this Monday to Friday plane. I think that was the one. Yeah, that was pretty happy about.
Right. So you were talking about the origin of it. So in when do you really think it is first noted?
The idea of, you know, engaging in that kind of physical congress with one's own mom is something that is so inherently, and I would think, you know, it's inherently revolting in a way that makes you recoil in a sort of, to me anyway, like caveman way. So I'm assuming it goes way back as one of the original taboos from when there
Right.
were like
Well,
600 people on the planet. So, but
based on,
first recorded use,
yeah.
I'd say probably in some monk religious texts in the year 200 or 300 or something. That would
No,
be my
well, what
guess.
I found was is that the first recorded version of it was in 1889, where during a murder
That
case,
recent? Oh, that's recent. Huh.
during a murder case, a witness was testifying that the victim had called the defendant a goddamned mother bastard son of a bitch shortly before his death.
1889. Okay, all right.
And apparently there was a court opinion in 1897 that you know was they were showing the transcripts and it actually has the words mother in it.
Nice.
And there's another case in 1917 where a soldier called the draft board, "You low down mother in a letter."
Nice.
So those are
Well done.
the different ones. Yeah. Now it does appear in George Carlin's 7 Words You Can't Say on Television.
That's right.
Right? He comments at one point in one of his HBO specials that someone asked him to remove it since as a derivative of the word it constitutes a duplication. He later added it back, claiming that the bit's rhythm doesn't work without it.
Yeah.
Typical George Carlin, you know.
It's true.
You sort of alluded to this when you were talking about Snakes on the Plane, but this is actually a catchphrase for Samuel L. Jackson,
Yeah.
who frequently utters it in various films, and that has a lot to do with the fact that he used it when he was younger to help him overcome a lifelong stuttering problem.
That's right. That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah. So, you know, A little bit of history on the word.
Yeah, like, well, I overcame my stutter by singing. What about you, Sam? I had a little bit of a different solution.
Exactly. Well, I mean, it reminds me of the King's Speech. He started swearing in order
That's
to help
oh
get rid of his
yeah,
stutter
that's right,
also.
that's right.
So again, I don't know if that how much of the dialogue there is based on truth, but still, it works.
Yeah, some of it sounds like it's a bit of a, not entirely made up or only, true in part, a
Right.
lot along with a lot of other therapy, he also used this
Exactly.
or something, for sure.
Correct. Correct. So now we get basically 30 seconds of action with no real sounds or no dialogue at all. As you mentioned earlier, we have the elevator bell dinging, which is a great movie trick to let us know at the same time that it's letting John McClane know that, someone has shown up on this floor.
Yeah.
So like he quickly turns around and we see we see a shot of the area, where the elevator is, and the music gets more tense as a figure starts approaching, the door, and we get to see that it's Tony, right?
Tony.
And he's got his gun at the ready,
He sure
right?
does.
So he looks around, he's looking around the room very cautiously. And it's funny because like he's looking around cautiously, but then he goes over and turns on the light switch. Like, where does he know? First of all, how does he know that these are this is the light switch that's going to turn on all the lights in the room? Obviously, he has the upper hand because he's not trying to hide. So
Yeah.
why don't I turn on the lights? That's
Yeah.
fine. And we see that this entire floor is still under construction.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, and then we get to see that McLean is hiding behind a stack of something. We're not really sure what it is.
Stack of
Tomorrow
what?
we'll get an idea.
Oh,
Tomorrow we'll
okay.
get more of an idea of
Oh
what it
yeah, that's
is.
right, that's right.
But he's standing there and he's crouched down and he's also got his gun ready. He McLean moves to the right as Tony comes to the left, which is really cool. It's a great effect. You
Yeah.
see McLean going to one direction and you see Tony going into the other direction. Right. And I mean they do a great job of keeping this scene really, really tense between the two of them.
Yeah.
Because they both don't know what to expect here.
Yeah.
And neither do we at the same time. And
Yeah.
then Tony begins to start talking and he goes, "The fire." And then he gets cut off. So people will have to come back tomorrow to hear what that rest of that phrase is after the fire.
Have we talked like one thing I always liked about the elevator ding is that it's used in great effect to in a lot of movies, because that's the like you're out of time. That's the like you're out of time sound. That's like, okay,
That's right.
prepping, 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 prepping. Ding. Okay. Uh-oh. Game on. And that's it, like I think it was used Cabin in the Woods, I think might have the best use of the elevator ding with all of the guards getting mulched by the monsters. Did you talk a little bit about Andreas Wisniewski yet? The Tony himself, the actor
Yes, we
playing
have
him?
talked about him, but if you have something you want to say about him, you can go right ahead.
I just
Besides the fact that he doesn't have very many other roles in movies, this is
well
his most prominent role that, at least for those of us who are diehard fans.
yeah yeah and I well he played Necros in the Living Daylights, and it's a really
Right.
sweet, sweet kitchen fight where he's gruesomely taking out the people in the kitchen, and he's great
Yes.
with the high kicks. He's a very tall, athletic guy. I found this
I think he's a, wasn't he also a ballet dancer, just like
I believe it.
Alexander Gudinov?
Yeah,
The
he
guy who
well
plays his brother. There you
yeah he's got that. I found like a speedo, a shot of him in a speedo on location in Morocco when he was filming the Living Daylights. And he's got that, ballet body. He's just like ripped, and like the muscle is dense and trim. And when he's doing the high kicks, yeah, you're like, whoa, that he's flexible too. He's not just,
Wow.
a rigid bodybuilder. He's got those that dance training. So he's got, and at the fight at the end of the Living Daylights where he's fighting Bond, hanging on to the packages hanging out of the back of the plane. It's an amazing, amazing sequence. And then he undoes the boot and he gets his boot and that sort of Fury Road maneuver. Here, have my boot. But he's very tall too, which he towers over Bruce Willis here. He towers over Dalton. And I guess he's
It
athletic
doesn't help
enough.
him.
It doesn't help him, no, but it's that you know, David, he's an instant David and Goliath situation when you're going up against Andres
Yes.
there. And he's athletic enough to do a fair amount of his own stunts, I imagine. But
I would assume. Yeah.
In the coming minutes, he does get there's some shots that are clearly not him. But and then according to the internet movie firearms database, Bruce has a Beretta 92F here, and Tony has a Heckler & Koch HK94, but it's been chopped and converted to look like a
An
MP5,
MP5. Yeah.
which was a very popular gun referred to as the Rolls-Royce of submachine guns.
Yes. Correct. All right, do you have anything else you want to say before we get into the script?
Nope.
Okay. So first of all, the script is changed around a little bit.
Okay.
Okay, because the beginning of this minute where McClane is looking out the window at the fire trucks coming actually happens in the script before Hans tells Eddie to call 911. So I mean it's a small little discrepancy, but it's interesting that the way that they cut it differently. I like the way they cut it in the movie as opposed to the script. Right, but it says McClane stands at the windows looking northward for fire trucks. Suddenly we see the flashing red lights of four engines in traffic 2 miles away. McClane, come on, baby, come to Papa. I'm gonna kiss your goddamn Dalmatian. So the Dalmatian part, as you said, was not ad-libbed, but Bruce Willis just changed the language a little bit. But instead of saying goddamn, added saying give me, I'll kiss your f-ing Dalmatian. I guess it just sounded a little better for him to do that. And then the script has the scene where Hans is telling Eddie what to deal with, and then it goes back to the area on the 32nd floor with McClane there, and it says McClane stands silhouetted against the window. In the distance, he can see another fire truck swing off Santa Monica onto the Avenue of the Stars. Suddenly, the red light of the first truck goes out. Then on the second, McClane watches in disbelief. The trucks slow and turn down separate side streets, heading for home. McClane, realizing what's going on, son of a bitch. And then it says, just then, the elevator bell rings, and we hear the elevator doors open. A figure, Tony, slips into the shadows, his machine gun drawn. We move with him from the elevator area until he reaches the light switch and throws it, illuminating the entire floor. McClane is gone. Then it shows McClane under a desk. He takes in his options, his point of view. The feet of Tony, they move slowly in his direction. McClane looks down the aisle next to the windows. It leads to a series of cubicles at the other end of the floor and is a clear path if he can make it past Tony. Tony moves steadily towards the area where we saw McClane, the fire, and then gets cut off. But I mean, we'll talk a little bit about this more, I think, tomorrow. But I like the fact that they mentioned here this is not a floor under construction. This is a floor, this is an office floor. There are cubicles, there are desks. That changes the whole dynamic of everything that's going to happen. I'm glad that they left it as a floor that was under construction. That works a lot better over the next few minutes. We'll get to see why that works better.
There's a lot of, shall we say, Jackie Chan opportunities in a half-built construction floor.
Yes, for sure. Okay, so every Monday we have a segment called Die Hard on a Monday, where my guests will give their top five Die Hard doppelganger films. So, Duncan, what have you got for us? Start with number five and work your way up.
Oh, okay. Well, do you want to start with five or honorable mention?
You can throw in an honorable mention, but it doesn't get points.
No, okay. Well, there was an honorable mention one. There was a movie called Masterminds, which is not very good, but it's Patrick Stewart and Callum Keith Rennie leading a team of terrorists into a rich kid's school in order to hold all of the students hostage. And
Sounds
what
like Toy Soldiers.
it is very, very similar to Toy Soldiers, except the kids are younger. The kids are like, whatever, 11 or 12 or something, instead of the sort of 15, 16-year-olds in Toy Soldiers. And I think in Toy Soldiers, it's a military school, isn't it? Am I wrong?
Yes.
Yeah. So it
No, is it a military school?
there's something
No,
about the sound of
it's
the sound.
not.
Oh,
No,
okay.
that's TAPS. You're thinking of TAPS.
Well, sure. But like, I just anyway, in Masterminds, they're sort of pampered rich kids, and they're on the younger side, except for one of them who's like, the working title was Smart Aleck, but then it got changed to Masterminds. I think they should have kept it as Smart Aleck because I like that a lot. But I was in it. I played one of the terrorists.
Really?
The terrorists on the tunnel under the ground. Callum Keith Rennie is leading them, and they wanted like a tall, skinny one, a short, round one, maybe a couple of twins. Like they wanted us to be like a motley crew of terrorists that are going in there. So I was the tall skeletal one that was on the team, and I got to like be in the makeup chair beside Patrick Stewart once, and it was wild to hear his voice not coming out of my television speaker, but coming out of his actual mouth. And he seemed like just a delight because he was asking the makeup girl, like, did the other makeup woman get the case of champagne that I sent to them, because they were talking about this type of champagne that they liked. And so he was like, oh, well, I know where I can get some, and had it sent to them. And so he just seemed like a really wonderful guy. And I completely restricted my urge to say, I'm such a big fan or anything like that. I just sat beside him and listened to his voice getting my makeup done. So that's my
Oh,
honorable mention.
wow.
The film is middling to fair, shall we say. But the oh, and the kid though, the kid, the 13-year-old, kid that like is the fly in the ointment and messes up the whole plan, went on to play in Mad Men again, the sort of whatever, the slimy guy, the tall, skinny, sort of slimy guy that's like on the same team as oh gosh, the guy, he's married to
Wow,
Elle.
that movie has Bradley Whitford, Matt Craven. Wow.
Vincent Kartheiser is the guy's name. He ended up playing Pete Campbell in Mad Men. It was a little ley line of a lot of different intersection of a lot of different careers, but it's not, don't get me wrong, don't rush out and see it. It's not a hidden gem, but it's kind of fun to pass the time if you feel like it. And it's always good to see
Oh,
Patrick Stewart play a bad guy. That's it's so rare. So it's, you see a double bill of Green Room and Masterminds to see him play a bad guy, or maybe
yeah, but
his.
I don't see you in on IMDb.
Oh,
Did you not have a speaking part?
no. I'm just I'm a glorified extra.
Oh,
In
wow.
okay, so starting at five
Cool.
for the rest of my Die Hard films, Lockout, which is sort of Die Hard in space. Guy Pearce is sent to a space prison to try to infiltrate the space prison and take over the space prison. And I think he's a criminal himself, but he has like, I don't know, Navy SEAL training or something. So they're like, you're our guy. I think. Now these are Die Hard style films, and it's kind of just one man against some stuff. So my choice number four is Taken, just
Okay,
because
that's fair.
he's it's his particular set of skills going up against In All Odds. Number three is The Raid, because that's in a building, and it's just working your way up the floors. Number two, I've got Con Air, which is sort of like Die Hard on a plane in a way. And then number one is The Rock. I really, really enjoyed The Rock. I thought that was a wonderful, wonderful film, which I think a lot of people are aware of. Like that's supposed to legitimately be James Bond. That's supposed to be, he got sent up the river and abandoned by the UK government. So he's ended up in jail in Alcatraz or whatever for a long time. So
Yeah. Oh, wow. Cool. Okay. Thank you for that. So you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you?
If you want to check out, you go to the timebanditsminute.com, go to hear the Time Bandits Minute that we're currently working, the Time Bandits Movie by Minute Experience that me and Curtis Blaze are currently working on. Or you can go to Chronologically Speaking and check out the entirety of my Movie by Minute treatment of the 1982 classic Tron. And then on that website, me and Courtney Colson have also gone over every episode of Tron Uprising, and Courtney's in the process of going through Tron Legacy in the movie by minute style. And so definitely all things Tron, go to chronologicallyspeaking.com.
All right, excellent. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcast catcher that you might be using to listen to this show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. And you can find me on my website. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!